सहनाववत् सहनौघुनक्त् सह वीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। So these chants that we do at the beginning and the end of classes, I can set up separate sessions. They're very beautiful. If people want to learn them, they're the chants that we learned that we do before and after every class, or at least before every class. So the text we're going to take is called Tattva Bodha. Tattva Bodha. Bodha means knowledge. From the Sanskrit verbal root bud, to know. And tattva means reality. It means truth. Tat is a pronoun. A pronoun stands for any object, right? Pro, for, noun, an object. Pronoun, for any object. In Sanskrit, it's called a sarvanama. It stands for sarva, all nama, names. You know, so in language you go, Joe went to the beach and he did this and he did this. That's the pronoun. And it stands for anything. Anything can be that. That book, that pot, that plant, right? That person, that. Tat, tat, tat. So the tat of tattva means that. The tva means ness. It gives it what's technically called an abstract neuter noun. It makes it an abstract neuter noun. It means that-ness, literally. The ness of that, the ness of that, the essence of this and this and this and this, and the essence of everything you can point to, the essence of that is truth. The essence of that is reality. So what this book is proposing to introduce is the knowledge of that essence of everything we experience, the experienced and the experiencer. It's a pretty lofty title. it's attributed to Adi Shankaracharya, who's a very famous figure. He wrote many, many centuries ago Sanskrit commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, on the Upanishads, on the Brahma Sutra. And he is very well known. It's attributed to him. It's short. It introduces a lot of vocabulary, which forms the basis for further deep study. It's the first book that Pooja Swamiji uses or teaches in the courses. So when I say Pooja Swamiji, I mean Swami Dayananda Saraswati, my teacher, who I met in 1981. He's in the habit of giving three-year courses, as I mentioned. And the very first book, he may take the Gita, some of the Gita, but the very first book he takes is the Tattva Bodha, because it's such a good introductory text. Swamiji suggested I take this text, and so here we are. And it covers a number of topics. These are methods of inquiry called prakriyas, and they come directly from the source book. The source book is the Upanishads, the Vedas. Some of you might be familiar with that. The Vedas are the Sanskrit scriptures of India, timeless Sanskrit scriptures called the Veda. And we'll talk more about the different literatures, the different types of books and whatnot. But very, very simply, the Veda are the source book for this tradition. And the Vedanta, the end of the Veda. Vedanta means the end. Anta means end. Veda is these books. So the section that occurs, Vedanam Antaha, the section that occurs at the end of the Vedas is called Vedanta. And they have a number of prakriyas, of ways of unfolding the nature of reality. And so what these prakarana granthas do, this Tattva Bodha, this text is a type of book called the Prakarana Grantha. It's a text which takes the methodologies from the source books, and it distills it and presents it in a unique way. There's a number of Prakarana Granthas. Some are introductory, some are very advanced, some are short, some are long. There's Viveka Chudamani, there's Atmabodha, there's Vakya Vritti, there's Upadesha Sahasri, there's a number of these texts. And this is one of those. So it's good to note that this is not a newfangled idea. Everything that I'm going to say, I mean, I will introduce some California-isms, if you will, in this. But all the ideas, all the methods, all the topics, all the points are not newfangled ideas. They come from these ancient texts. It's not a patented, copyrighted, modern notion that came out of somebody's head. So how do we listen to this book? Tattvabodha, knowledge of reality. How do we get knowledge of reality, right? So one thing to note is that these classes are not meant to be an intellectual, theoretical, speculative exercise, right? This is not an exercise to gain information about something that then you then need to go practice. Classes should be considered more of like an open-eyed, open-eared meditation, because the intention is to reveal the truth of what is right here, right now. It's not a cookbook. So when you have a cookbook, you have an intention to create something through action. You read the book and it tells you to gather certain objects, certain ingredients, and then it tells you to do certain things with those ingredients. In Sanskrit is called ling lot davya. It is imperative. Basically, it says you take this and you do this. You take this, you cut it up, you fry it, you stir it, you add these spices, you put it in the oven, you do whatever it is you do, and the result is a tasty dish. It's like chemistry class. You know, you take the beakers of these different chemicals and you mix them up and you try not to blow yourself up. And at the end, you know, based on this theory, you have some result. This is not like that, because this is meant to be a revealing of what is. And it's more like pointing to a star. So let's say you're outside and you're looking at the star and you know a certain star in a certain constellation, and you're sitting there with a friend and you say, I want you to see the star. Do you see that star up there? And you point and you say, you see, so here's the trunk and over there is this branch. You see that branch off to the left there? And then you go and there's three branches that kind of pop up from the left of that. I mean, from up above that. Just you go to that far branch up to the right, and just at the very tip of that, you see that bright star right there? You see that bright star? And your friend will go, oh, yes, I see that star. And this teaching is more like this, right? The teaching is that you don't really want to pay attention to the finger and really the teacher. And you don't necessarily even, you know, in the end, the finger disappears. In the end, the tree disappears. The teaching itself disappears. And what you're left with is the meaning. You're left with the meaning of what's being said. And that's how the mind can understand and see the topic, see the meaning of what's being taught. And the way to do that is with what is called Shraddha. Now, Shraddha it's this. We have a scaffolding, a philosophical, everyone's a philosopher. Everyone has philosophies in life. And we've created this internal structure, an internal scaffolding about what reality is about. And then if we've been seekers, if we have been spiritual seekers, we've developed this and become invested in certain ideas about what the spiritual path is about, what the pursuits are, what the sadhya is, what the goal is, what the sadhana is, what the means to that goal is. And we've created a lot of structure. And when we come to a teaching, we often filter what we hear through our existing internal structure, our internal scaffolding upon which we hang all of our ideas, which make our reality. And the problem is, we, you know, the thicker that screen is, the less we actually see, the less light that actually comes through of what's being said. So Shraddha is a temporary suspension, putting aside of that scaffolding to just hear what's being said. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't question. Shraddha is not a blind belief. This is not, Vedanta does not ask you to believe anything. Vedanta doesn't ask you to do anything. It's not like we're going to be learning how to cook dosa right now, and we're going to go out and later on for breakfast you can have dosa. As nice as that might be. It invites questioning. And sometimes when people approach a spiritual teacher or a spiritual teaching, they're discouraged from questioning, right? They think it's a matter of faith. If I just believe hard enough, it will become true. And this tradition is steeped in questioning. The Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the primary texts, one of the primary texts of the Prasthanatraya, the three main texts of Vedanta, is Arjuna asking Krishna questions. And he's bold enough to say, Krishna, you say this, but it's confusing. Or you're as though talking nonsense. Tell me what you're talking about. The Upanishads are all form of a dialogue between a student and a teacher. And in fact, the Bhashyas, there's a huge literature of commentaries on these texts, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the Brahma Sutra, and they're all in the form of dialogue, not only between teacher and student. You know, the relationship of teacher to student is one of, you know, the mind of a student is one that's open and trying to understand what the teacher says. But in these bhashas, there's what's called Purvapaksha Siddhanta. The Purvapakshis, these combatants, almost, if you will, these alternative views of reality, these speakers come in and they have dialogues with the Vedantin. And the Purvapakshi, this objection, may come and say, you say the world, everything is blue, but we think everything is yellow. This is why we think everything is yellow. And the answer will be, well, everything is blue because of XYZ. And there's these very elaborate discussions that go on because you want to sharpen your understanding. You want to remove error. You want to remove vagueness. And you want to remove doubt regarding what you understand. And that is, again, a very fundamental cornerstone practice. It's called mananam of this tradition. The three main aspects of sadhana for this tradition are shravanam, mananam, and nididhyasana. The nididhyasana we talked about earlier, that's what's going to be we're going to lead to the meditations. The mananam is this questioning, and that's why we have question and answer at the end. And then shravanam is this. Shravanam is listening to what the shastra has to say, what the sacred scriptures have to say, to understand what it's all about. So this shraddha, the way we listen, is not meant to quell or meant to push down any sort of questioning. But this openness to what's being said is necessary. So putting this internal scaffolding aside is useful and necessary for understanding what's being said. There's a phrase we can say in Sanskrit. Sarve praninaha sukha praptaye dukha nivrittaye cha pravartante. It says, all beings, sarve praninaha, all beings live their lives, pursue their pursuits for two reasons. One is sukha praptihi, the praptihi, the attainment of sukha, of happiness, of pleasure. And dukkha nivritti, the removal of dukkha, the removal of unpleasantness, anxiety, sorrow, pain, discomfort. And these are our pursuits. Sarve praninaha sukha praptaye dukha nivrittaye cha pravartante. All beings, all living beings, even animals. Shankaracharya, in his Adhyasa Bhashya, at the beginning of the Brahma Sutra, his introductory commentary, he says, people are very similar to Pashwadayaha. People are very similar to animals. Because when a cow sees a man with sweet grass, fresh grass in his hand, he will come over and be attracted to that. He will pursue that. There will be pravritti. There will be a pursuit of that sukham, of that happiness. And when he sees a man with a stick in his hand who's going to threaten him, the cow thinks, that person is going to do harm to me, and he runs away. Dukkha nivritti, the removal of the possibility of hurt, of sorrow. And so it's a very natural setup, right? This is how we go about life. In an unexamined life, this is what we do. That's how we live our life, right? We want to gain, we want to elevate as much sukham as we can, as much happiness, pleasure, joy, contentment, satisfaction as we can. And we want to diminish the other, the opposite of that. So when we look at how do I spend my time? How do I spend my attention? There's something very sacred about attention. We have very limited resources. Time is one of the most precious resources we have, right? When you stop and think, it's a fool who squanders time, because we all know our time on earth is going to end sooner than later, right? And attention, there's something very sacred about attention. I know that, say, when I'm in line for groceries, and there's a baby in the carriage in front of me, in the cart in front of me, and the baby looks at me with these beautiful eyes and just looks. It grabs, you know, babies are programmed to find faces. We see faces in things, you know. So they're programmed to see the face, and they just look at you with this innocence and with this purity, just with pure attention, that kind of this quizzical, you know, who are you? I often feel like I'm having darshan. I feel like I'm having a vision of the sacred because of the purity and just the pure attention that's there. So when we give our attention, when we pay attention, we're actually investing our capital, our personal capital, in what we pay attention to. We're spending our life. How do you spend your time? You only have so much time. You only have so much attention. And what you give your attention to becomes part of you, right? You give your attention to something, and you bless it with your attention, and you consume through your attention, because you bring things into your mind, into your heart, into your psyche, into your life through your attention. So what is it that we spend our time doing? What is it we spend our attention doing? We seek novelty, and we seek distraction, right? Oftentimes we wonder, you know, how long can we go without checking our email? How long can we go without checking our Twitter account? You know, oh, who's posted something on Facebook? We want novelty. We want something fresh, you know. Last year's music was good in its time, but I want the latest release from whomever. You know, I don't know who the latest musicians are, but I want the latest release. I want the latest music. You know, I want the latest book, this author I like. You know, the other book was okay, but newer is better. I want fresh. I want new. I want more. And I want to be distracted. I want this television. I want this sensation. I want this conversation. I want this relationship. I want this. We want distractions. Distractions from what? Interesting question. So there's a pressure, a relentless pressure. There's a restlessness. There's as though an itch that we have to keep scratching. There's as though there's this empty spot I keep trying to fill in my life through this pursuit. And the pursuit can be seen in this way. We really see the world. There's really three things in this world, and only two that matter. One are the sukha-karanas, the sukha-karani, the karanas, the causes of sukha, of pleasure, of happiness, of joy, contentment. And then there's the dukkha-karana. There's the things that cause sorrow, right? There's the things to which we attribute the capacity, better said, the things to which we attribute the capacity to cause joy, sukham, and the things that we attribute to which we attribute the capacity to give us dukkham, sorrow, or the opposite of joy, opposite of what we're looking for. And then the third thing is the things I'm indifferent to, the things that I don't label as being joy. You know, they're not the joy makers and they're not the sorrow makers. They're things that really aren't on my radar. You know, I don't really care too much about them. And what we do with the things that we want, that we attribute the capacity to give us joy, are that we may have them, we may not have them. Those that we don't have, we put our attention, our effort to acquiring. I want a car. I want a promotion. I want a relationship. I want peace. I want my partner to be different. I want a healthy body. I want a prettier body. I want to be stronger, wealthier, wiser. I want all these things that I may not have. And so I spend my effort acquiring those things, pursuing those things, giving those my attention. And those things that I attribute to having the capacity to give me happiness, giving me sukha that I already possess, I spend time retaining. This is called yoga kshema. Two words, yoga and kshema. Yoga means a lot of things. Yoga means a chapter. It means, you know, asanas, positions. It means discipline. Here, yoga means acquisition. So we do the acquisition, the yoga, and the kshema, and the retention of those things. And each of those cost us time, money, and life. Yoga, kshema. And on the other hand, we have the dukkha karanas. Dukkha karanas are dukkha, things I don't want. I don't want those causes of sorrow. And so I spend my time, there's those that I don't have, right? And I want to keep away. So I spend my time, I don't want wrinkles. I don't want a car accident. I don't want ill health. I spend time keeping those things away from me. And then there's those things which I don't want, which are dukkha karana, which I already possess. And those are the things I'm trying to get rid of. I'm trying to get rid of this pain in my knee. I'm trying to get rid of whatever they are, some relationship, or let's say I have an old car that's just a pain. You know, it's just I need $2,000 worth of work on it, and it's just such a pain, and I just want to get rid of it. I just want to get rid of it. And what we're doing here, it's not when I desire something, it's not that I really want the object. I mean, I could want the object, like I want an iPad. Okay, so I could use the iPad. I could use a car. I need transportation. I need communication. I need a way to, you know, interact with the world. I need these things. But really, we're looking for the ananda, the sukha that we attribute to those things, right? And those things, we'll look at that more closely, but we're really looking for the ananda and not really the thing. And really what we're looking for is not really the ananda, not really the sukham. We're looking for the sukhi. We're looking for, the sukhi is the one who has sukha. The sukhi is one who is the pleased self. Sukha means pleased. You know, sukha is happiness, joyful. And the sukhi is one who has that joy. So really what we're seeking is not the objects, not the particular circumstances, but we're seeking, and not just that experience, we're seeking the pleased self. We're seeking that happy, joyful, natural state that we're so comfortable with. We're uncomfortable with dukkha. We're uncomfortable with sorrow. And that's why we try to push it away. We're uncomfortable with sadness. We're uncomfortable with pain. It's not natural to us. We push away things that are unnatural to us. We're very comfortable with happiness, right? How much happiness do you want? How much happiness do you want? Oh, you know, I think I only want about 2 hours of happiness today. I can't take any more happiness than 2 hours. When do you want it? Oh, I think I'll have happiness between 8:30 and 10:30. What degree of happiness do you want? Oh, I think on a scale of 1 to 10, just give me a 4. That's all I want. You know, if you crank it up to 6, it may be too happy for me. I can't take it. You know, no, what we're looking for is limitless happiness. We're looking for that place where we're completely at home, where there is no tension, there is no conflict, and we have complete fullness. We're looking for happiness which is limitless, which is not time bound, which is not, which is unfettered in terms of quality, in terms of quantity, in terms of time. And that's that sukhi, that happy, pleased self that we're looking for. So this is our filter through which we see the world. We can go these things that are cause sorrow, these things that cause happiness. And this is the prism through which we see the world. This is our desire template, our desire system, if you will. And it defines how I interact with people. If someone is able to give, to help me fulfill some of these desires, then you're my friend. If someone gets in the way of having me fulfill these desires that I want, then you're my enemy, right? If you look at me with love in your eyes and you confirm to me that I am lovable, you make me a sukhi. I want you. I will do anything to get you, and I will do anything to retain you, because you make recognize that I am a lovable person, that I know I am, but I don't seem to recognize an awful lot. And if you hate me, if you dislike me, I push you away, because you touch that place in me where I feel unlovable. I feel not worthy. I feel, you know, I don't feel good. So we go through and we make demands on the world. We manipulate the world, right? We manipulate the objects we bring in and we push away. We manipulate place, right? And time. We say, some people say, I can't be happy here in this town, in San Diego. I need to go to Los Angeles. Now, that might be a bad choice. Sorry if you live in LA. Let's say I live in Arizona and I think I can't be happy in Arizona. I need to go to Nebraska. Well, the curiosity is that those things that cause you dukkha, that cause you unhappiness in Arizona, I bet you that you're going to find those same things in Nebraska. Even though we try to manipulate things, we think, oh, well, things will be better in Nebraska. Time, we'll say, okay, well, I'll be miserable now, but I'll be happy when I go to on vacation. Well, I get 2 weeks, I'll go to the Bahamas, I'll lay out on the beach, I'll numb myself out with with pleasure, and I'll just pretend that I'm not this dookie, this painful person. I'll forget about all those things that, you know, work and my car that's falling apart, and I'll just have a good time. So we try to manipulate the world around us. We try to grab objects, right? We collect this, we collect this, we collect this, we collect this, and we have trouble letting these things go. Why do we have trouble letting objects go? Because the acquisition really gives us a little opiate rush inside our brain, you know, a little endorphin or a little dopamine is released when we get something we want. And then we attribute that happiness to that object. And even though it may not be giving us any more happiness, I can't let go of it because at one time it gave us that happiness. And so I fill my life with all these trinkets, all these collectibles, all these things that no longer are meaningful when I see them, but I can't let them go because at one time they gave me sukham, they gave me that happiness. So we think, I need this, I need this, I need this, I need this, I need this. And that this is always changing, right? At one point, I need this, I need a new car. Once I have a new car, I need this other thing, I need this other thing. That this is always changing, but the I need is constant. The I need temporarily goes away when I have a desire satisfied, but the I need keeps popping up and it keeps projecting onto various things. This is why Amazon is so successful. This is why it's dangerous to get Amazon Prime, because you can have anything you want in 2 days and all you need is a push of a button and you say, what do I need to satisfy myself now? I want that, I want that, I want that, 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 that. That need is always there. Once you get this, you need this, you need this, you need this. So it's almost as if we're walking around our life with, and everything around us has these little labels. You know, there's, I think there's video games. I don't play video games, but, you know, I've seen them on the interwebs, so it must be true. Where you know, your avatars. Don't you love that? Avatars in the games, they have labels, you know, so you know who you're playing against, and you know, like, their strength. And it's almost like we're the prism through which we see the world. They say, oh, that object will give me 10 ananda points, 10 sukha points. That one will give me 1,000 sukha points, so I need to really work hard to get that one. And that one's going to give me 100 dukkha points, so I'm going to stay away from that. And that's the world we live in. And then we try to combine these things. Well, we say, no, it's not this particular thing. It's not this particular thing. It's the combination of things. We're looking for the perfect bubble bath. So we think, okay, I've had a hard day at work. I need to relax. I need some me time. I need some me time. So I'm going to go have a bath, a warm bath, a relaxing bath, a me time. And the water should be 104.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's a perfect temperature for my bath. And then also, I think I should have a bubble bath, not just a regular bath. So I need, the water would be 100.45 degrees and a bubble bath. But I think I need some scented oils. That would make it perfect in there. That would be perfect. So 104.5 plus bubbles plus the scent. And I might as well have incense going at the same time. That would be great. It'd be so relaxing. Aromatherapy, right? So 104.5 degree water with bubbles, with sandalwood oil, with incense, and with music. Wow. Okay, so I could have Enya playing. So I have 104.5 degree water, and it's going to have bubbles. It's going to have sandalwood oil. I'm going to have incense going. I'm going to have music. I'm going to read a book. I'm going to have the book. I'm going to lock the door, and I'll have my me time. So these it's a lot of work just to have some me time, you know, just to relax, to forget about everything, just to put yourself in a state of mind where there's no pressure. There's just you. All you need. You need all these crutches just to be with yourself. And these things that we need become subtler and subtler, right? You know, some people just need, you know, some gross enjoyments. Some people need subtler enjoyments. Some, they become more and more refined. And if actually the more and more refined it is, the more expensive it becomes, because it's not just you need a certain type of food. You need a certain type of food that's imported from such and such, and it's only available from Whole Foods in this extra special section of the grocery store. So we're always looking for increasing that anand, that sukham, increasing the duration, the intensity, and the quality of that. So how successful are we? How successful are we in manipulating the world to make it all work? I have this imagery that came to mind when I was thinking about this. You know, there's this childhood toy, a pegboard. And all it is a piece of wood, or a box, let's say, a piece of wood or a box. And the top of it has holes in it, maybe a dozen holes, right? And they're of different shapes, different sizes, and different colors. So you have maybe a round hole of a half an inch, a round hole of a 1 inch, a round hole of 2 inches. You have a square hole. You have a triangular hole, and maybe a star-shaped hole. And they're all different colors and different sizes. And they're used by children 2, 3, 4 years old. To help with hand-eye coordination, you know, they can learn their colors, they can learn their shapes. And you take the peg and you just drop it, and it disappears into the box. It disappears into the box. And we're sort of like that. It's as if we have this pegboard on our chest, and we're always looking for the special pieces that will fill those holes in our soul, And we're looking for, oh, this thing, this experience, this trip to Tibet will fill this empty spot in my soul, and it's square and 2 inches wide, and that's the perfect fit right now. And this relationship, that person will fill that empty spot in my soul, that piece where I feel lacking. And that's a star that's special, and it's gold, it's golden color. And so I'll take that, and that will fit right there. And then this other object, this new house, this will fit, you know, fill this empty spot that I have here. And the poignancy of that is that it will, you know, these pegs are 2 inches long, and it will fill that empty slot for a short time, and then it just drops into the void. It just drops into emptiness. It drops into the box. And there you are again with this empty hole. And you're searching for another peg that will fill that. And we're constantly trying to juggle these balls, to switch metaphors, to keep feeding these slots. It's like having a monkey on your back. It's like having an addiction. And, you know, there's enough, there's not only that, but there's these advertisers that are constantly trying to not only sell us things that we already think we need, they spend millions and millions of dollars trying to convince us that we need things that we don't even know exist yet. And they spend millions of dollars in psychology just to poke at you, just to tell you, you're not quite right. You are not acceptable unless you have this shoe, you use this perfume, you have this car, you drink this beer, you watch these programs. If you do that, then you're hip, you're trendy, you are acceptable. We can help make you acceptable at only three easy payments of $19.95 each. And how successful are we at filling these holes? The problem is that it's all time bound. All of these acquisitions, all these attempts, everything, those dukkha karanas, those things that we want to keep away, slip in, right? The bubbles in our bubble bath, they all pop. The water gets cooler and cooler. I drop my book into the bathtub and it gets all wet. Someone comes pounding at the door and saying, where's dinner? You know, it all comes back. You can't keep it at bay because everything is time bound. All of these things are limited. And it's a bit like, not to become too morose, but it's a bit like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It's to change metaphors, it's like building a house on quicksand, right? We'll build a house and then it'll start sinking, and we need to build more houses. We need to build another level. And then we need to build another level. And we're not getting closer to our eventual goal of some distant, limitless ananda, limitless sukham. We're actually just kind of staying the same. And we just have to keep building and building. There's something called the hedonic treadmill. And I don't know that much about it. But it's basically what accounts for the fact that when someone can win the lottery, someone wins $5 million, you ask them in a year and they'll say, I'm as happy as I was a year ago. I'm no more happy. Your happiness set point, you always come back to your same happiness set point. And so you keep having to build and build and build and build. You have to keep going. Why are these billionaires still trying to make more and more money? It's basically endless. And when things don't go my way, I feel sad, I feel lonely, I feel bored. And so what's the definition of insanity? You've heard that, right? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And it's actually... It's actually grace when we see this, because it is the beginning of mumuksha. Moksha means freedom. Mumuksha means a desire for freedom. Mumukshuhu is one who desires freedom. So most of us are so busy pursuing this that we have such an unexamined life. But when you stop and perhaps reach a moment of despair, you know, Thoreau said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. And it's very sobering. I've heard people say, you know, they've lived what we think is a full life. They've done everything they thought they were supposed to do. They've acquired everything they thought they were supposed to acquire. And in the end, they say, I thought there'd be more. Is this it? I thought there'd be more. And that's grace. To see that, that's grace. The earlier you see that, the better. Because you begin to start wondering, why is this game not working? The game is set up, and I'm not winning this game. You know, I could appear to win. I could have all the trappings of success, but there's still this empty spot. There's still something that's lacking. I don't feel content. I'm not happy. All of this is not working. So why isn't this working? So look at this. You take fire and you heat a pot of water up, right? The heat that is in the water, is that intrinsic to the water? Is the fire, is the heat that's in the water that's been heated up through the fire, is that intrinsic? Is that inherent in the water? It's not. It's borrowed. It's incidental to the water. The water in, you know, everyday life is cool. And the heat in water is incidental. It's not inherent. And it's dependent. The heat in the water is dependent on the fire. And therefore, it's temporary. Because when the fire goes, the heat goes, and this incidental property, which is dependent on the fire, goes. Now, is heat incidental or intrinsic to fire? Heat is intrinsic to fire. It's the very nature. You can have cold water, you can have warm water. The warmth is not intrinsic to the water. Can you have cold fire in everyday life? No, there is no fire without heat, and there is no, you know, heat without some form of agni, without some form of fire. So fire is the very swarupa. Heat is the very swarupa, the very nature, the intrinsic property of fire. And it's independent, right? That heat is, which is the intrinsic nature of fire, is not dependent on anything else. And therefore, it's permanent. It's nitya. It doesn't come and go with fire, right? I mean, when fire is there, it's always there. You know, when water is there, the heat is not always there. When the fire is there, the heat is always there. So we have incidental or borrowed properties which are dependent and impermanent. And then we have intrinsic properties, which are independent and permanent. And the rub here is that no object, no situation, no person in my experience, no experience that I have has intrinsic sukham or ananda. There is no object that is inherently sukha-karanam, that is inherently the cause of joy. If it was, I would patent it and I'd become a multi-billionaire if there was such an object. And there is no object that has the inherent attribute, you know, the inherent attribute of sukha-karanam, of being the cause of happiness. That happiness is not inherent in anything that we have, anything we can possess, any experience. It's a borrowed happiness. And we'll have to look into where that happiness is borrowed from. But it's a bad ROI, right? So we have a certain amount of capital of our life. We have a certain amount of attention. We have a certain amount of lifespan. And to hang my happiness on external situations and objects is a fool's exercise, because we're just setting ourselves up. Everything is time bound. Everything is bound to change. We have such limited capacity to create this the perfect situation that I want. It's not a great investment of our time. And there's no solution in adding things. There's no solution in subtracting things. There's no solution to be in the process of becoming, right? I want to become someone who has certain relationships, certain experiences, certain possessions, certain attributes. I want to be someone who's devoid of certain experiences, certain people, certain relationships, certain objects, certain attributes. And this constant becoming, this constant need to try to become something other than I am, is called samsara, is called the struggle of life, right? And it's very natural for an unexamined life. It's very natural for an animal. The thing is that for an animal to be successful, for a cow to be successful, it just needs to be born, it needs to survive, it needs to procreate. It needs to find food, it needs to procreate, and it needs to avoid the slaughterhouse. It takes a lot more for a human being who's endowed with intelligence and the gift of a human life and the self-awareness that I have that allows me to feel that I need to keep struggling. I need to keep struggling. The thing is that we seem to be looking all in the wrong place. So is there a solution for this? Is there some moksha? Is there some relief? And so in closing, we'll say the Chandogya Upanishad gives a statement. It gives a pratignya. It's called a pratignya, an assertion. And it's an assertion that invites a lot of investigation and understanding. And it says, Tarati shokam atmavit. Tarati shokam atmavit. In more common classical Sanskrit, it would be atmavit shokam tarati. Atmavit, kaha atmavit. Who is the atmavit? Atmavit means, atma means oneself. And at every level, we can identify ourselves, the body, the mind, the senses, everything. But truly, the atma is the truth of myself. Saha yaha atmanam veti, saha atmavit. The one who knows the truth of oneself is an atmavit. Atmavit tarati. The one who knows oneself crosses. Kim tarati atmavit. What does the one who knows oneself cross? He crosses shokam. Atmavit shokam tarati. He crosses shokam. He crosses sorrow. He crosses this struggle, this constant need that we have, this sense that I'm lacking, this sense that I need, the sense that I'm this wanting person. And there's a very good reason why we take ourselves to be this wanting person. We'll talk about that next week. It's very clear why I take myself to be less than everything I want to become. This atmavit shokam tarati really means that I already am what I seek to become. It doesn't appear to be so, but it's this assertion that is the case. It's not a matter for belief. It's not like, okay, so now I believe, now I have the intellectual knowledge, as if there were nasal knowledge. Now I have the intellectual knowledge that I am, if I really know myself, I will be complete. So now I need to go out and do something to understand. All you need to do is to know who you are. How do you do that? Well, you expose yourself to a means of knowledge for understanding who you are. And this, tattva bodha, the knowledge of reality. Knowledge of reality, what? Why would you want to know reality? What's the payoff in that? Why do I care about reality? I want to be happy. You care about this because the reality of what? Kasya in Sanskrit. Kasya tattvasya bodha. The bodha, the knowledge of the reality of what? Atmanaha, tattva-bodha, the knowledge of the reality of oneself. That's another name you can give. You can add atma, atma-tattva-bodha. This text, tattva-bodha, is really explores the reality of oneself, the truth of oneself. And the Upanishads, the Shastra says, atma-vit-shokam tarati, the one who knows the true nature of myself, when I know the true nature of myself, I've crossed this sorrow. I've become what's called a krita-krityaha. I'm sorry about all the Sanskrit. I'm translating everything as I go. It's just such an exquisite language because it's so expressive and it's so suited for this pursuit. Krita-krityoham, I am one who has done everything that needs to be done. I am one who has accomplished everything. It doesn't mean that I've made endless amounts of money. It doesn't mean that, you know, I have limitless wealth. It doesn't mean I have limitless security. It doesn't mean I have limitless objects. It doesn't mean that in terms of all the measures by which I can measure worldly success, it doesn't mean that I've necessarily accomplished anything. I can have no possessions at all. And I can say, krita krityoham, I have accomplished everything that needs to be accomplished, because atma vit shokam tarati, the one who knows the truth of oneself, crosses the ocean of samsara, crosses this constant struggle, and fills those holes. You realize that, you know, this pegboard that I talked about, you can stop filling those holes, because in truth, you don't have these holes in your soul to fill. Once you know the true nature of yourself, you don't have any holes that need to be filled. You can go and engage in life, and you can go and buy a car, and you can go and buy an iPad, and you can go and have a job and have a family and make good food and make good money. You can do whatever it is as your destiny calls you. But you're not trying to make up. You're not trying to build this house on quicksand. You're not trying to make up for an insufficiency. You live your life out of a sense of fullness, out of a sense of completeness, out of a sense of ananda, out of an inherent sense, right? We have this incidental happiness, which is impermanent, incidental to all these objects, right? We're trying to find happiness in all these incidental happiness. Really, when you know the truth of yourself, you find and the intrinsic happiness, which you are, which is not subject to time. And therefore, it's not a function of action. It's not a function of acquisition. We don't need to do something to acquire that sukham. We don't need to do anything to push that dukkham away. We merely need to understand that the model I have about myself, based on the ignorance of myself and all the conclusions I've made about myself as a limited human being, are questionable at best. And so next week, we'll look at questioning those assumptions we have about ourselves and take this inquiry one step further. Let's sit for just a moment, just a couple minutes. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yankshobharahitah brahmanah santu nirbhayah om sarve bhavantu sukhinah Sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchit dukkha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, om pur Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Om Tat Sat Sarvam Ishwararpanamastu. Anybody have any comments or questions?
Thank you.
Yeah, Dakshaji, this was really enlightening. I mean, you can hear me okay, right, Dakshaji?
Yes, you sound fine.
I think when you were talking, I was also kind of like thinking over a similar philosophy that was that I heard somewhere, which says that there is no way to happiness. There's no way to happiness.
There's no
happiness.
Way?
There's no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. Yeah. Exactly what you were saying, right? Like if you keep seeking for it, that's not what it is. It's you're already enjoying happiness. That's the way you have to kind of approach it, I guess. So,
yeah, I mean, maybe another way to say that is that the source of all happiness is already present. It just needs to be discovered. And the place that, you know, there's some old song, I don't even know it, but I just know the lyric that says, we're looking for love in all the wrong places. We're looking for sukham. We're looking for our completeness in all the wrong places. And so we just need to look in the right place, which is the truth of myself, so that happiness isn't a karmapala. But happiness is not a result of action. And it's not even in the pursuit. It's a pre-existent fact that we just are not cognizant of, because we take ourselves to be something other than we are. So yeah, good point.
And Dakshaji, on that a related point on, you mentioned a couple of times about what is it that one has to know about oneself, right? Like, let's say for argument's sake, I get enlightened by your talk and and I don't care for like the Hummer or the 6-bedroom house, a swimming pool in my backyard or whatever, right? And I become almost a sannyasi-like person. But then what is it that I'm looking for after that? I mean, what does it mean by asking the question, I need to know about myself? Should I just be like a dumb person? Not seeking anything, there is still at that point, there's something that you have to achieve or like there's something that you need to do, right? What would that be like if I don't care for the material acquisitions?
Well, you know, I mean, you mentioned two things. One is lifestyle, right? There are some people who, and this is, Krishna talks about this a lot in the Bhagavad Gita. He talks about there's two lifestyles. There's the renunciate lifestyle, and there's the engaged karma yogi lifestyle. And so, you know, if you see the truth, if you're enlightened, if you will, if you're a jnani, one who knows the nature of things, can choose a lifestyle. You can choose to be actively engaged in the world, or you can choose to not be a participant. You can choose to be a monk. In that sense, it really doesn't matter one way or the other, if you really understand what's going on. So the question is, what do you do? What is it? What motivates you to engage in activities once you understand that your fullness is not dependent on anything else? And in that case, the whole world is just an expression of Bhagawan. The whole world is an expression of Ishvara, the Lord. And whatever comes to you is your prarabdha. And we'll talk all about this. But whatever comes to you is your destiny, is opportunities, right? And opportunity sounds not the right word because it sounds opportunistic, right? You need to accomplish something. But really, if you have nothing to accomplish to make yourself free, to make yourself satisfied, then you can choose to do anything. But the thing is, you're not bound to doing anything specific. You're born into certain circumstances, and your circumstances draw out appropriate actions and responses from you. I look at my teacher, Swamiji, and, you know, he tried to go live up in the banks of the Ganga. I have friends who met him up there, you know, in the 70s, and he just had a little hut, and he would just be sitting by the bank on the banks of the Ganges River, teaching. And then his prarabdha is this karma that's fructifying in this birth, that's giving us our experiences in this life, and part of our karma, if you will, our prarabdha, is other people's will, right? They'll ask things of you. The situations draw out responses. And so it's not like I don't have things to do. You know, I still need to, as they say, chop wood and carry water. I still need to go get my car smogged, you know, and I still need to take care of my loved ones. And I still, you know, need to do all those things to honor the circumstances of this incarnation. If I don't have any need for the situation to be a specific way, then everything becomes an offering to the Lord, and everything just becomes lila. Everything becomes play. Everything is just, Bhagawan wants me to do this. The situation calls for this, and I'll do it. I just do what's in front of me, and I have no expectations. I don't have, I mean, in terms of that satisfying me, because I don't have that need.
Oh, very well put. Thanks, Dakshaji. That was a very good explanation, I think. So, yeah.
I'm happy.
I was thinking more like, okay, when once I reach that intermediate stage, okay, I have to read books or something. Okay, but no.
Yeah, no, once you know, and, you know, so listening to the Shastra, listening to the teaching is really important. It's the, you know, at the course that I talked about, it's the three-year course that we went to, you know, we would have three or four classes a day, and we'd all be studying the Upanishads, the Gita, the Brahma Sutra, because there's so many areas where I take myself to be less than I am. I take myself to be subject to sorrow. And, you know, Krishna says his verse of the teaching, you know, the 11th verse of the second chapter, Ashochan Anvashochas Tvam Prajnava Damshta Bhashase. You're grieving for things that don't need to be grieved for. I mean, Krishna just says it right there. You know, you're mistaking the whole situation. You're not seeing this clearly. You're speaking like you know what you're talking about. Prajnava Damshta Bhashase. But you're sorrowful for all the wrong reasons. There is no reason for sorrow. And if you still have these places in you that are subject to sorrow, then sitting with the teaching, asking questions to help clarify, sitting with meditation, nididhyasana, those are the way to help clarify really the true nature of oneself. So,
excuse me, but sometimes, you know, things happen in your life that cause you sorrow. You lose a dear one, you lose your parents, you lose. Then what do you, I mean, how can you not grieve for them?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because we're human, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, Arjuna was in a very bad predicament. I mean, he was in the predicament of having to kill his teachers and, you know, his cousins, exactly, right. And Krishna has the chutzpah, so to speak, to say, you know, you don't need to grieve for those all these people. Now, my experience is that we need to honor this incarnation, right? We're human. And I feel that grief is a natural expression of being human, right? We don't, a jnani, someone who knows the truth of things, is not, is not subject to the normal sources of sorrow and pursuits of happiness. But I think there's some basic fundamental, I mean, you have relationships, and when those relationships end through death, it's a perfectly natural reaction to have sorrow at those times. I don't think that's an expression of one's ignorance or one's not understanding the truth. I just think it's a perfectly natural thing. And I think the grieving process is perfectly natural. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a different thing. If you understand really where you're, if you have a relationship with your mind and you have a relationship with really what the source of your joy is, and you can still let those emotions come through, you don't cling to them. It's like, it's almost like when those strong, powerful emotions come by, it's as if they're on the palm of your hand. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to push them away. You're not trying to grasp them. They just come. It's the nature of the mind. Part of the mind is an emotional self, right? You want to, you can feel happiness. You can feel sadness. You can feel this gamut of different levels of happiness. You're not like this, you know, this, you're not at like one plateau, like a robot, and, you know, everything is the same. You know, everything is the same. There's variety in your internal landscape, in your internal experience. It's just that our relationship is so much different. I don't need my mind to be a certain way for me to know that I'm full. Sorrow, natural sorrow can come. I can accept that, and I don't grab onto it. I don't judge myself by the obtaining condition of my mind. I don't say, I am sorrowful just because sorrow manifests, right? The mind can have all sorts of changes, but if I don't define myself by the obtaining condition in my mind, that I'm free and I'm allowed to experience the whole gamut of what life has to offer, and yet I'm not bound by it.
The point that you made about Arjuna was he lost his son Abhimanyu in that same battle.
Yes.
So according to Krishna, on one side, Krishna is saying, when he says, I can't do this, or I can't deceive Karna and all that, he says, but you're forgetting that what they did to your son, right?
Yeah.
So he's evoking those emotions in him to get him ready, right, or in a state to fight.
Right.
Because that is the important part.
Right. But
he didn't allow him to really even grieve for him. But at the same time, so sometimes the Gita confuses me, and the way Krishna acts, sometimes it's just like, he's deceitful and at the same time he's doing it. So maybe you will throw some light on the Gita from the aspect of how should we deal with these conflicts that appear in our life. Sometimes to do the right thing,
yeah,
it's okay to deceive. Does the end justify the means? On one side you say it doesn't, and the other side it says it does.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I hope you'll be able to clarify, because we're just trying to live our life here.
Yeah. And Dharma is a very tricky thing, right? I mean, you know, Krishna wanted Arjuna, we're running short on time.
Yes.
And I don't know that I have a ready answer for you, but Dharma is very situational. We'll talk about Dharma. There's universal Dharma, and then there's situational Dharma, right? Samanya Dharma and Vishesha Dharma. And every situational Dharma has its own requirements. And Krishna definitely saw that Arjuna wanted to run away. He wanted to say, oh, I'm going to become a sannyasi. It was not his place at that time to do that. He needed to do what was right. And from our perspective, there are a lot of things that seem adharmic now that were dharmic at different times. You know, if I wanted to have three wives,
right,
now we would think that'd be adharmic. But back in those days, if you had the resources, you could, you know. I mean, Draupadi could have five husbands.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, the short answer is Dharma, the Vishesha Dharma, the particular Dharma of a different place, certain place in a different time, are particular to that place and time. And the whole, you know, the Mahabharata has so many it's beautiful because they're all so many ethical dilemmas. And then you look at how people interact and people solve those ethical dilemmas, and it's a great source for conversation and potentially confusing, because you say, oh, that, does that make sense? How would I do it? And, you know, I see it as a learning tool, with some models it presenting as being a bit more congruent with our own sensibilities around Dharma in the 21st century, and some being a little less congruent.
Thank you. And the biggest irony was, at least with my limited knowledge, after all that Arjun does at Krishna's behest, it is Yudhishthir who actually gave away his wife in a gambling game, who achieves heaven. And so it really blows my mind what my scriptures are trying to tell me.
Yeah.
So I hope you throw light on this through that situational dharma. So I really look forward to it, and thank you very much.
Okay, good. Yeah. I mean, you look at it, it's a, you know, irony is that, you know, it's a, one way to gain moksha in the Itihasas is to be killed by an avatar,
exactly,
right? So you can be a demon, And then Ravana, you can get your all 10 of your heads chopped off and you're free. So it's very interesting to look into those questions. So we'll eventually get to those.
Thank you.
So we're past 9 o'clock. I'm trying to wrap these classes up by 9 o'clock. So unless anybody has anything else that they'd like to say, thank you very much for coming. And I do hope to see you all next week at 7:30 next Thursday. And we'll continue into this investigation of Tattva Bodha.
Is it 7 or 7:30?
7:30. Beginning with the meditation at 7:30 and then class starting about 15, 20 minutes after that. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.